Everybody. Today it's a pleasure to have speaker Sebastian, a researcher that I met a few months ago. Sebastian graduated, obtained the PhD at the Nisbol Institute in Copenhagen. Then he moved to France as a postdoc fellow at the INRIA, the French National Institute for Digital Science, in Nancy, and actually based at the IAP in Paris, working with Roya, who joined us. Hello, Roya, thank you. And Moya. And more recently with Elena, where shell density field starting from actual position of the galaxies. So starting work on the last case structure. I forgot to mention that before he did the PhD working on CMB physics. More recently, he moved as a Casbeck Foundation Fellow, postdoc fellow at the Institute of the Center for Theoretical Physics in Oxford, where he's keep working on CMB and large scale structure and on the test of cosmological principle with a quasar, which is the topic of his talk today. So Sebastian, it's up to you. I remind to people that you can interrupt him and ask at any time, not waiting for the end of his talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlo, for this very nice introduction. Yeah, that's right. So if you have any sort of questions, just interrupt me in the middle of my sentence if necessary. I have a box that is covering half of my screen here, saying that this meeting is recorded, and I'm trying to... I think I'll just stop sharing for one brief second to undo this box. Here we go. Okay, you can see this, right? Wonderful. So yeah, as Carlos said, I'm gonna talk about a paper that we published at the beginning of this year, in which we tested the cosmological principle with a specific test I'll tell you about with a quasar sample that we constructed. This work was done together with Nathan Seacrest, who's been working on quasar samples for quite some time, with Mohamed Ramiz, with Roya, as you know, Subir Sarkar, and Jacques Collin, whom you may also know. I want to start with something that brings me back to my hometown, which is the object you see on your left. Erdapfel is German, which means earth apple. Has nothing to do with a potato, even though it almost looks like one. It is the first globe that was constructed to map the continents of the Earth that were known to that point. And as you can see from its date of creation in 1492, this was the year Columbus sailed across the Atlantic in an attempt to visit India. What you can see on the right-hand side is basically just a sketch of how Martin Behaim, the creator of this globe, mapped out the Earth, and apart from slightly distorted continents and country borders, Italy is not really a boot, it looks more like a hand, and some islands are missing. One big island is missing, and that is America. The reason for this was not only that people didn't know of America yet, but in order to construct a globe, for the first time, the maps made of the Earth had to be connected. And if one had known that the circumference of the Earth is as large as we know today, we would have had a huge gap in between Europe and Asia. And we don't see this on this map. And the reason for this is that the circumference of the Earth was estimated by, well, many geometers and mathematicians of the past, and the estimate that stuck was the one of Ptolemy, that didn't measure 40,000 kilometers but only 30,000 kilometers. This was basically the standard all map makers referred to when mapping out the edges of countries, and Nobody expected the continent of the Americas. There was just no space on a map. The reason I'm bringing this up is because not only was cosmography back then a term that referred to map making of the Earth, and of course should be topic of this talk, but also the fact that people did not expect the Americas on our globe was due to an assumption, and this assumption being that Ptolemy estimated the circumference of the Earth correctly. As I should tell you in this talk today, there are other assumptions which we use in the cosmography of today, in cosmology, that may need to be tested as well before progress could be done. So cosmography today, this is the obligatory cosmology slide on the left, deals with mapping out patterns and positions of galaxies. And we do that by choosing a metric. We conveniently choose a maximally symmetric metric or one that is symmetric in its spatial components, the Robertson-Walker metric, which by construction fulfills the principles of homogeneity and isotropy, which we refer to as the cosmological principle today. And I should get back to that in a second. But not only do we pick a particular metric that fulfills these principles, we also adhere to these principles in the construction of the energy momentum tensor in the Einstein equations. So also there, we find that in the homogeneous limit, the energy momentum tensor reduces to what we learned in our basic cosmology courses, this diagonal matrix. There's of course more that follows exactly from these very simple assumptions, but in essence, all our cosmology is based on these fundamental assumptions of homogeneity and isotropy, upon which we construct linear perturbations and so on. So the cosmological principle is one that has to be defined. It is not only the universe follows homogeneity and isotropy, but it should be possible to define it a bit closer. So on the left-hand side, I show you the CMB, which is a map of the early universe that has been investigated with regards to statistical isotropy and homogeneity. And in fact, it does look isotropic, and it does look Gaussian to a high degree. And these small perturbations I mentioned are very small, and everything fits in the same picture. However, in the late universe, when we do have galaxies and galaxy clusters, the fluctuations are not that small anymore. And we might question, on which scales do we expect isotropy and homogeneity to hold? And so the definition I show on the right is one by Dominic Schwarz, in which he says that the distribution of light and matter in the universe is statistically isotropic around any point, apart from local anisotropies. And local is to be defined. So obviously in our local environment, we have, and here you see a slice through the local group. On the left-hand side, you see the density field. We have galaxies and galaxy clusters that make the field or make the density field in our local vicinity not all too homogeneous. So there must be some smoothing scale applied until we can really speak of a homogeneous field. Another thing which I'm showing on the right hand side is the inferred velocity field from the density field. So here the authors of the paper applied some Bayesian reconstruction in order to infer the velocities, and what you can see is that there's a velocity infall towards massive structures like these clusters, for example, Shapley, and an infall from the other side, denoted in blue, also towards these massive structures. What is shown here is the radial velocity. One way to test homogeneity is to say, and I mentioned the smoothing scale, we could investigate the fractal dimension, in this case, D2, the left of the two lower plots. In any sort of random field, you would expect that if you zoom in very closely, you'll see all the granularity introduced by this randomness. And if you zoom out more, if the field is indeed homogeneous, you'll have some smooth distribution. And the fractal dimension, which is the exponent of the increased mass or density, really. If that is 3, we have a statistically homogeneous field in 3 dimensions. And you could look at this field in spheres with increasing radius, smoothing out scales below this radius. And what you can see is that for the DS simulation, that is the dark sky simulation, huge n-body simulation, at around 100 megaparsec, we find this fractal dimension to converge to the value of 3, which is exactly what we'd expect in a homogeneous universe. on the right-hand side, you see the equivalent, the corresponding velocities. Of course, if there are structures below 100 megaparsec, you would expect that these structures lead to random velocities. And in this case, this is the magnitude of the peculiar velocity or the bulk flow of this volume. And we see that with increasing radius of the sphere, the velocity decreases, also an expectation of what would happen in such a random field. I'll get back to that later. Both of these things are simulations. They're not real data, but I'll get back to real data later. A definition of the cosmological principle one could make is that all physical quantities that are measured by a co-moving observer are spatially homogeneous isotropic. And that is important for cosmology because, of course, we want the local estimate or the estimate we make of certain cosmological quantities from our point of view not to be biased, but to be representative for the universe, meaning if we had performed the measurement from a different point in the universe, the result should have been the same. So this definition is quite tricky because it includes the word co-moving. And in fact, a co-moving observer can only be defined in a Robertson-Walker metric. Dominic Schwartz is certainly aware of this, but I find this definition quite amusing because it is to some degree circular. But this just illustrates how fundamental how ingrained the cosmological principle is in our understanding of physical quantities in cosmology. So what is a co-moving observer? If we look at the CMB, not at the scale or not in the way I show you on the left, but we actually include one of the strongest contributions to the CMB, the dipole. The CMB just looks like this. You have a strong dipole pointing in one direction that we usually interpret as being the Doppler boosted monopole. Our motion with respect to the bath of CMB photons induces this huge anisotropy. And interpreting this dipole as being purely due to this boost, to being a boosted observer, is in fact central to understanding of what co-moving means. We can boost our observer or our observations to the CMB rest frame, and we can then say that CMB rest frame is the rest frame of the universe. But it is based on the interpretation that the CMB dipole is in fact only kinematic. That is, to just elaborate on that, the CMB itself could have some intrinsic dipole, meaning that the universe at an early stage had a built-in anisotropy that led to a dipole, and then the interpretation of this dipole to be purely due to kinematic effects would not be true. So how can we, these are just the numbers, just for reference, the velocity with respect to the CMB rest frame can be inferred from the CMB dipole to be 369 kilometers per second. We know the direction as well as the velocity to a high degree under this assumption that the dipole is kinematic. I'll skip that. So how can we test whether our velocity with respect to a cosmic rest frame is the same as the velocity with respect to the CMB rest frame? And so what we can imagine is that we're our observer that moves with a certain velocity as shown in the diagram before with respect to the galaxies in the local group. So since those are at fairly close distances, we don't really care about them and in the spirit of the cosmological principle. So we could imagine that we move with respect to other rest frames, for example, a rest frame by very distant galaxies, as well as with respect to the CMB. And there might be a distinction there, and this is exactly the distinction that we try to exploit in the study I'll tell you about. So just to give you a short intermezzo, the cosmological principle and the tests I showed you before has been, or these tests have been applied using real data. And on the left-hand side, you can see probably the most famous plot that measures this fractal dimension. And you see that the data points do converge to this value of 3 at around 100 megaparsec. However, I should say that the black points are not really only data. They're data and simulations. There's the red points that show the data, and the black points assume that a certain volume outside of the volume of the surveyed volume of this experiment follows the cosmological principle and follows homogeneity, and this is how it would go on had the data obeyed homogeneity. However, the survey is just too small to actually probe scales beyond 100 megaparsec, and therefore we don't actually know whether we have converged to this value of 3, to this homogeneous value, or whether there might be something to discover beyond. So essentially, we have to wait for bigger surveys. On the right-hand side, you see this bulk velocity measured at different scales using different experiments, in this case, redshift surveys. And what one can see is that generally a trend is followed in which the inferred velocities at increased scale radius decrease. However, there might be some small tension between the data points and the expectation. I should say that there are two curves here, that is a blue one and a green one. That just depends on how you smooth this volume within which you average. There's small tensions, and convergence can really not be claimed. But the trend at least looks correct. So we need other tests of the cosmological principle. And so what we did is we used a test that was devised by Ellis and Baldwin now almost 4 years ago, which said if we have a sample of objects in the sky that is isotropically distributed, so we would assume for a galaxy sample of distant galaxies, not in a local group, but at distances beyond 100 megaparsec. And the spectra of these sources, of these galaxies, for example, would be power laws in frequency. And furthermore, the differential number count of such a catalog would also follow a power law. Then a dipole in the distribution of objects can be found that is proportional to the velocity with respect with which we move with respect to such a sample of objects. And the reason that, or well, the way this dipole comes about is due to two reasons. First is the spectra being Doppler boosted, and the second being aberration, stellar aberration, which we know from special relativity. The word I highlighted is a flux limiter catalog. So what I show you in this diagram is that if you have a catalog where you cut away those objects with fluxes below a certain level, you could imagine a case that when you measure within the blue band, you here have a source that has a flux that is below the flux threshold, and therefore this source would not appear in your catalog. However, if you now Doppler boost it with respect to the source, the spectrum will be boosted, and suddenly the source appears in your in your measurement, which means that the direction in which you move will contain more objects in the direction from which you move away, where the spectrum would be pushed down. So that creates an imbalance in the number density of objects. And the second effect is the stellar aberration, where you here see a map of isotropically distributed objects and an observer that is boosted in the direction of the red dot would see these objects close in on the red dot. And I hope you can see that I'm going to flip back and forth. You will also through aberration expect an increased number density in the direction in which you're moving. So these two effects combined would create a dipole in a distribution of initially isotropically distributed objects. And that can be tested using samples of distant galaxies. So that has been done for a while using radio catalogs. So what we can do is we can plug in the expectation of this dipole. We know from interpreting the CMB dipole as being kinematic, the velocity with which we move with respect to the CMB rest train, these 369 kilometers per second. We plug that into beta, we plug into X and alpha numbers we expect from radio catalogs, and we find an expectation for the dipole amplitude of 4.6 times 10 to the minus 3. So these studies have been done almost for 20 years now, the first one being done by Blake and Wall in 2002. All studies give dipole amplitudes that are larger than this expected dipole amplitude of 0.0046. There are some discrepancies between the different results, which may be due to systematics and different treatment of the data. But consistently, all give dipole amplitudes that are larger than expected, which could be interpreted as us moving with respect to these samples of radio galaxies with a higher velocity than that with which we move with respect to the CMB photons. So the problem is that the large variance in these results could have many sources, and that is that these catalogs are quite small. So we have low statistics, they have around 100,000 sources. The radio catalogs have been surveyed from Earth, so we have atmospheric systematics, we have maybe side lobe pickup from the ground and all these different effects. There are bias estimators and local contaminants and all sorts of effects which could mess with the final results. So what we tried to do is we tried to find an isotropic sample, or we tried to find a sample of distant objects to test for isotropy that does not suffer from these potential influences. And I may come back to the slide in a bit. What we did is we moved from the radio to the mid-infrared to find a quasar sample. So quasars are radio loud galaxies, galaxies that are typically at high redshift or a redshift of around one. And they have been surveyed by satellites such as WISE. So WISE has collected a million to 10 million sources, and such catalogs have been constructed before. What we did in particular is we used the CatWISE catalog. They have funny names. There's UnWISE and there's CatWISE. CatWISE is one that collects data from all different phases, all different observation phases of WISE, and it uses an updated or an improved source detection algorithm to make out these sources. So that seemed to be the best choice for us. And what we do after, while taking into account all these objects, is we select for AGNs. And we select for AGNs mostly by employing a color cut, which means we select for spectra that have a certain spectral index or higher. And this color cut of W1 minus W2 That's what you can maybe observe in this diagram on the right, that if W1 minus W2 is larger than around 1, what we select is mostly QSOs and AGNs, and a small amount of dwarfs, which we take care of by other means. But all these spiral galaxies and stars and ellipticals are essentially cut out and will not be part of our sample, which is what we evaluate or what we validate by other means. We apply different masks and we remove sources that are spurious. You can ask me about those details in a bit. Or not. This is the density map on the top left of a Quasar sample, where you see the masks that we applied. We applied masks for the LMC and SMC, certain bright sources, and excluded a large strip of the galactic plane to remove any local contaminants by our own galaxy. And on the right-hand side, you see an inferred a redshift distribution of these objects, which we find by cross-matching a subsample of our quasars with SDSS to obtain spectroscopic redshifts. And we find that they are indeed at high redshifts, and we therefore expect, if they're at high redshifts and therefore large distances, that they would make a good candidate for testing isotropy. There are different details that distinguish this quasar catalog in the mid-infrared from such catalogs in the radio, which, well, first of all, have to be accounted for because they're different, but second of all, made us quite happy because indeed the mid-infrared, a sample in cataloged in the mid-infrared would be independent of that cataloged in the radio. So again, we try to separate ourselves from the results previously obtained with radio catalogs.
So can I interrupt? I have one of those questions I've been encouraged to ask. How many objects are there in this mid-infrared quasar sample and in the radio one?
In this sample, after all of our cuts, we have 1.36 million objects. So that is, almost essentially an order of magnitude more than the number of objects in the radio catalogs used so far.
Okay, thanks.
One thing that I'm going to move back to this now because it is conceptually interesting to distinguish which contributions there are to the finely measured dipole in this density of objects. And what I show on the top is that you have a kinematic component, which is the one produced by the effects I showed you before, by the Doppler boosting and aberration. You have a local component, which is if you have local sources, just like maybe members of the local group, of course those anisotropies could induce a dipole. If you don't have those, and you only have very distant objects, you wouldn't expect a dipole if the sample is indeed isotropic. Include a third term, a bias, that depends on the estimator which you use in order to estimate this dipole. We've made sure that our estimator is not biased. Previous studies use biased estimators, which explains part of the scatter. And you can ask me more about that a bit. And the last contribution, and that refers to Matt's question, is shot noise or Poisson noise that comes about simply because a random sample of even isotropically distributed objects could still have an intrinsic dipole just by chance. And of course, the larger the sample is, the lower this this noise component, as I call it, would become. The lower the chance is that an isotropic sample of a certain number of objects would have a large remaining dipole, just by chance. So, the way we deal with these things is that, we want the local clustering dipole to be small, so we move to higher redshifts, and we keep the bias contribution small by, or zero by using an unbiased estimator. And lastly, the dipole from Chandra's would also be kept small by using a galaxy sample that has more than a million sources, roughly. So this is how the density map to, well, on the left-hand side, the density map smoothed with a certain scale does actually already reveal the dipole. And that was quite nice to see when we did that. So we do find a dipole in this distribution of quasars. And estimating its direction, we find it to lie here, where the red triangle is placed, which is somewhat close to the CMB dipole. I'll get to what this disk around the CMB dipole means in a second. The amplitude of this dipole we estimate as well. But of course, just having a number for this amplitude is not enough. We want to essentially understand, is it significantly larger than the expectation we have if we were to consider this sample of quasars to be Doppler modulated and aberrated with the velocity we expect from the CMB. And so for that, we run simulations. And these simulations are rather simple. We begin with an isotropic distribution of objects. We input the CMB velocity in the direction of the CMB to aberrate these sources. We then assign to each source a pair of flux value and the spectral index alpha, which are essential to the computation of this dipole. And then we apply all of the cuts to the same simulated catalog as we do to the real catalog. We do that many times, and we do it exactly 10 million times. And each time, we estimate the dipole direction and dipole amplitude. So what we find is this histogram on the lower left, where the mean value of the histogram is exactly the dipole expected from the CMB velocity. The reason that it is not at 4.6 times 10 to the minus 3, as I said before, but at 7 point something times 10 to the minus 3 has to do with the specialties of the mid-infrared catalog, in which the details are not exactly the same as in radio catalogs. And we find a spread around this value. So these are all the dipole amplitudes found in the simulations. And compared with that, we see that the amplitude found in the CatWise catalog lies much higher than any of these, or than most of these. And we can estimate from this the p-value with which we would obtain the result you find in the data just by chance from any of the simulations. And this p-value is very small, it's 5 times 10 to the minus 7, which corresponds to 4.9 sigma in Gaussian statistics. So this is essentially,
we have a bit running out of time. So
running out of time. So then it's good that I can come to the second to last slide, and then I'll show you the last slide. Second to last slide is simply a compilation of different such measurements that which have been done. Radio dipoles, supernovae have been investigated for velocity for such a dipole. And there have been these dark flow results using the kinetics and the Yavorovitch effect. And all of these kind of point in the same, roughly same direction, which is just to show you, maybe a coincidence, but maybe there's some connection between them. So the summary, and I can come to something else afterwards, is simply that most cosmological probes rely on this cosmological principle, homogeneity and isotropy being correct. And we therefore should be sure that it really is correct. And in this work, we have found that the dipole in a quasar sample of more than a million sources is much larger than the dipole expected from the CMB. And this dipole amplitude being inconsistent at such a high significance does not only mean that maybe the velocity is wrong, in fact, it means that the assumptions of a of a universe that follows homogeneity in isotropy, namely the cosmological principle, are inconsistent with the result. And so I'm showing you another picture, also done in my hometown in Nuremberg, by Albrecht Dürer, who was told to paint a rhinoceros. He's never seen a rhinoceros in his life. So it's nice that he gets kind of close to it. But even though these animals do look beautiful, they don't look exactly like painted in this picture. So also this picture is based on assumptions. And I'll just leave you with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian, for this very nice talk and conclusion. Is there any comment or question I have, but please? Let's see, raise hand. Well, let me start with this conclusion here. You're putting a very small p-value. I see two questions, actually. So, please, Gillen.
Yes, so this may be a very naive question, but could you take into account any systematics from the fact that we could be in a special void or something like that, that could change the dipole measurement? Or?
So, the question is, how large would the void have to be in order to explain this? So in order, in the construction of these simulations, we assumed that the sample to compare to, which means that, I mean, the assumptions for each simulation would be that the sample is indeed isotropic and homogeneous. If we were off-center in a void, that wouldn't be the case anymore. And I assume that you mean being off-center in a void, or at least being in a void that is somewhat oblate. Mm-hmm. So there, those assumptions wouldn't hold anymore. However, since we know that our sample is at high redshift, centered at high redshift, as you can see in the top right, we wouldn't expect that a small void, as at least the voids we know of in our local vicinity, could account for this. So what we need is a huge void, and sure, I mean, estimates have been done in other contexts, but I don't think that we really believe that we live in a void of 1,000 megaparsec or more.
So for you, it could only be due to the hypotheses that are wrong.
Right. I mean, if we do have a void of 1,000 megaparsec or so, one that would actually affect the number density of objects in our sample, that itself would likely violate statistical homogeneity. What we did in this paper is we wanted to find a clean test in order to test whether the sample does follow expectations from homogeneity and isotropy, and it doesn't. But you're right. I mean, if we had a void of that size, maybe it could explain our results, but it would be equally in variance with the cosmological principle. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Matt, please.
Thanks for the very interesting presentation. It's quite thought-provoking. So just on some sort of practical aspects, the sample being used here is, I guess you would say, photometric. So you're driven by the numbers crossing boundaries in bands. If you had, some of my colleagues will know why I'm asking this question. If you have spectroscopy, if you have a spectroscopic quasar sample, would you expect to do better? At what level? I mean, to what extent are these sort of the precision of these sort of in retrospace important?
Right. So that's a good question. Since obviously, if you had a spectroscopic sample of quasars, you'd be very happy. because not only will be able to exclude one effect I'll tell you about in a second, or which I told you about already, but also we could estimate this dipole at different vectors, which will be very interesting to scan. But everything we really care about is that, and I think I have it here, that we have a sample of objects that are at large enough distances from us that this term, this dipole contribution from local effects is excluded, or at least is kept very small. And for that, we only care about sources of low redshift to be excluded in our sample. What you can see here is we have a small number of objects which do have a low redshift, but they don't really contribute to the bulk of it. And in fact, we estimate this to be less than 1%, and it is also at the order of 1% of our final dipole that these local objects could contribute a clustering dipole, as I show here. So we only cross-matched a small subsample of our full catalog with a spectroscopic sample, in this case SDSS, in order to get a good guess of this redshift distribution. Optimal would be having a full spectroscopic sample, but it is really only this local contribution that would require us to have a good knowledge of redshifts. Everything else in the analysis is independent of that.
So you don't mind having a bit of a mixed bag so long as it's not low redshift effectively.
Right.
And the detailed redshift precision. So, you have these boundaries that must be crossed in order to enter and exit the sample. And as long as those are clearly well-defined, as long as you have those boundary crossings, you're satisfied. It's interesting, surprising. I would have expected some sort of importance to redshift errors to this, but so maybe we should talk afterwards because I can propose some quasar surveys that are ongoing or coming up.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Sebastian, how much your results are affected by the specific footprint of your study? Did you test what happens to your measurements on simulations eventually using different survey masks?
So why is being a satellite and not a ground-based experiment that would be affected by many, many things? Luckily, it has a very smooth scanning pattern. To first approximation, we can assume that we have scanned the full sky, and we therefore don't have to take into account crooked survey volumes, as with, for example, SDSS. The depth of the survey that is constrained by the flux cut which we apply. So by excluding objects with very low fluxes, very faint objects, we exclude those far away, and we sort of expect to have captured all objects within a sphere of a certain radius given by this flux cut.
I'm wondering about the angular mask.
Right, so the angular mask is the one you see here on the left, but that is not constrained by the scanning of the satellite itself, or not by the surveying, but it is constrained by those objects which we would consider spurious. So for example, bright objects within the LMC or the SMC, or anything within the galactic plane. We, of course, don't want to be affected by that. That's at least how I understand these effects, that the survey volume is the one that is given by the actual scanning. But the mask you see here to the left doesn't have to do with the scanning. It has to do with those sources that we want to exclude, just because they're spurious. And then I should say that, of course, the mask which you see here on the left, that mask we also apply to all of the simulations. Just like all the flux cuts. Yeah, so we wouldn't be affected by that.
Eric?
Yeah, hello. So yeah, I just had a question. I missed the part where you mentioned the dependence on the redshift. Where does that comes in?
That comes in here. So there's in a Lambda CDM universe, in a universe that follows the cosmological principle, we would expect that sources which are very close to us could have some clustering. In fact, I showed you one. It's not only an example, but this is actually a measurement of sources that are close to us. I just have to find the slide again. I think it's here. Yes. So sources which are close to us, and us being the center of this image. Of course, there's an anisotropy, right? So measuring the dipole in this distribution in this density field would give you a non-zero value. However, this is not the dipole that interests us. This is what I would refer to as the local dipole or local clustering dipole. What we are interested in is a dipole in a distant distribution of sources, not affected by these. So essentially, we want to exclude those sources which have low redshift, those sources which have small distances to us. And therefore, we are interested in the redshift. And once these slides move, I can probably show you. therefore, we're interested in the redshifts of these sources and want to exclude those redshifts, or at least keep low those the number of sources with redshifts that are very low. The way, and this is what I can maybe talk about briefly here, is that a local clustering dipole can be estimated from just applying linear theory using this formula. Where we have the matter power spectrum, which tells us about how many, how big fluctuations we should expect at a certain scale. And we have this factor F, and this factor F contains the redshift distribution of the objects. And so what we find to be the contribution of this D local for the redshift distribution of our objects is this value, is 2 times 10 to the minus 4, compared with 1.5 times 10 to the minus 2. This is scaled with the bias, a linear bias, and it could be scaled with a redshift dependent bias. So depending on what the bias of the sources are, this will not only be 2 times 10 to the minus 4, but a bit more. And the bias of the sources, by looking at the 2-point correlation function, can be estimated to be somewhat close to 2. So, well, this will be 1 times 10 to the minus 3. Which is still low compared with the actual result. If you look at the comparing the distribution given by the simulations and the actual result, so the red line would essentially not change. Does that somewhat answer your question?
Yeah, I see. And the power spectrum is computed at which redshift in the formula?
The power spectrum would be computed. Oh, sure. I don't have a redshift dependence in here. I should have put that in there as well. So F and P are both dependent on redshift as well. So you can bin both these quantities and therefore use the redshift distribution which we have in the data.
Yeah, so you integrate also on the redshift distribution.
That's right. That's right.
I see. No, because I was thinking when you cross match the EBOS sample with your catalog, mm-hmm. have to be careful in this because neither of the two samples are complete, so might get some wrong estimate of the mean redshift by doing a simple cross match.
Yeah, so we, in the end, we settled on using the deepest and therefore most complete band of the EBOS footprint, Stripe 82 is called, for this reason. But we also, in previous attempts, used other parts of the SDSS or just the full SDSS and full SDSS given different data releases. A sample in order to perform this cross match, and the distribution of redshifts essentially look the same. So always we have a median of 1.2 in redshift.
Mm-hmm. And also I missed, the reason why you started from the quasar sample and not, for instance, the LRGs or any other sample of galaxies.
So quasars we simply picked because we expected them to be at higher redshift and large distances. LRGs we could probably pick, though I wouldn't expect them to go out as far. And in this case, the choice of the quasar sample was made quickly by the expertise that Nathan could contribute to our work. So it's somewhat easily constructed by performing these color cuts in the mid infrared. But it would be, of course, interesting to use other samples as well, given that they're at high enough redshift and that they are not prone to systematics that would interfere with the results, or with any result, really.
Yeah, and also I guess it's because of the coverage over the full sky, right?
That's right. We want full coverage, or close to full coverage, at least.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, I see in the chat a message from Matt Pieri. Sebastian, who's sorry, has to go. He will send you an email for the proposal he made. So I think we can stop here after almost an hour of chatting. Thank you, Sebastian, again. And just let me advertise next week's seminar on unusual time at 5 p.m. done by Alex Idiotol. Speaking from California, that's the reason why it will be at 5 p.m. So thank you again.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye, Sebastian.
Bye.